KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. What would you say if you had 5 minutes on stage and a captive audience? That's the premise of Ignite Seattle, a regular worldwide event where presenters get 5 minutes to get a point across. Speakers at November's event touched on a variety of topics, including living in two cities, superbugs, and little-known facts about Hamlet. Ignite Seattle 22 took place at Town Hall on November 20th. The talk was moderated by Seattle Times columnist Monica Guzman.
So a lot of you probably drive by. Some of the activity goes in our waterways and all those ships and all those boats. And a lot of you, like me, know absolutely nothing about what's going on those ships and those boats. Our next speaker, Christine Klimkowski, is going to fill you in. Christine.
Good evening, Ignite. I am a merchant mariner, and it's my hope tonight that I can explain to you what that means and why shipping and the Port of Seattle is important to you. Simply put, merchant mariners are civilians like myself that work on commercial vessels. Now, I know what you're thinking. No, we don't all look like this guy. We are average, your normal next-door neighbors. In fact, there are 69,000 mariners here in the United States. We typically work in one of three departments on board the ship. There are the stewards that help provide the crew with food. There's the engineers that manage the ship's propulsion plant. And then there's folks like me. I work in the deck department, and we're in charge of the safe navigation of the vessel, all of the safety equipment on board, and we also take care of the ship's cargo. And yes, we still use sextants on board ships. Mariners are qualified to work on a variety of ships, everything from tugboats to tankers, car ships to container ships. And one thing that I love about going to sea for a living is I've been able to literally travel the whole world. This is one of my old ships, the Midnight Sun. She's 855 feet long and designed to carry tractor trailers. Here you see her in the beautiful port of Anchorage, Alaska. I've ridden this ship and many ships to all sorts of foreign and exotic ports. Now, ships like this one and the Midnight Sun have fairly small crews. In fact, the Midnight Sun had a crew of 23, which means we often do many jobs. As a chief officer, I'm responsible for the ship's stability. I'm also called upon to be the ship's medical officer with EMT-like qualifications. I'm also the ship's security officer, as well as being in charge of the cargo, all of our safety equipment, and a couple of other things. Now, being a merchant mariner gives me a lot of unique opportunities. It also provides me with a fabulous living wage. In fact, I was making six figures by the age of 25 without a bachelor's degree. There's also a lot of job stability, and there's a lot of long-term career options. A lot of mariners go from working at sea to shoreside maritime jobs. Now, I'm sure you're wondering, how does this apply to you, landlubbers here in the crowd? And it applies to you because ships move 90% of all goods. Ships are also one of the greenest ways to move cargo. It takes a ship 1 gallon of fuel to move 1 ton of cargo 600 miles. And when I say that ships move 90% of all goods, I mean 90% of everything. Your cell phone, your car, your hoodie, your sneakers, it came on a ship. And that makes us really unique here in Seattle because we've got a port in our own backyard. In fact, our port is the 10th largest container port in North America, the 8th largest in the U.S., and we are the largest port, period, in the state of Washington. The Port of Seattle brings in a little over 21,000 direct jobs. Now, for a point of comparison, Microsoft has about 3,500 employees. So we're up there in terms of what we provide to our local economy. It's also $2.5 billion in revenue, which provides a lot of direct and indirect and induced jobs as well. And along with that revenue comes, of course, all of the taxes. Ships produce and contribute to our state, local, and city economy a huge tax base. Now, if you wanted to take just a small portion of the industry to kind of have an understanding of how big the effect is, the cruise ship industry alone that operates between May and September brings in almost $330 million each year. That's pretty significant for our local economy, for our state economy, and for our national economy. Now, shipping is an international industry, and in fact, Filipino mariners make up the largest single constituency of crews. In fact, about one out of every five crew members is Filipino. So tonight, I'd like to call upon you to help support my fellow seafarers, to support those in the Philippines by donating to the Sailor Society, the Mission to Seafarers, or the Filipino Red Cross. Hopefully, you've gotten a sense of how impactful the maritime industry is on our local economy, and you keep an eye out for us when you're out in your boats and when you see us in the port. Thank you.
Thanks, Christine. Our next speaker is going to tell you five things you don't know about Hamlet. Steve Roth.
Hey, so number one, jumping right in. Most people think that the Hamlet they read in high school or college is the Hamlet, but in fact, there were three editions published in Shakespeare's day, and there are like 2,000 differences between them. Whatever you read was an editor's mashup. The first quarto, for instance, it's half the length of the other versions, and it's really a mess. Listen to this. To be or not to be? Aye, there's the point. To die. To sleep. Is that all? Aye, all. The rest of it is just as bad. Though there are some passages that are very accurate. But think about it. This is an actor who was on stage with Shakespeare in the earliest production of Hamlet reporting to you. Second quarto came out a year later, newly imprinted, enlarged, and to almost as much again as it was according to the true and perfect copies. In the first folio, Shakespeare's collected works, they were complaining about stolen and surreptitious copies. There's some big differences. Hamlet's last soliloquy is completely missing from Q1 and Q2, and other speeches are completely rewritten or missing from others. There are also some little differences, for instance. Oh, that this too solid flesh would melt. In Q2, it's sallied flesh, which has some wonderful multiple meanings. And most editors modernize it to sullied. There are more things than heaven and earth are dreamt of in your philosophy. In F1, it's our philosophy. These are little differences, but again, there are hundreds, thousands, and some of them make a difference. For instance, no matter how much you might think otherwise, Hamlet is not 30 years old. Everything in the play says Hamlet is 16 or 17, except for this one crazy conversation with that he has with the gravedigger in the graveyard. How long has there been a gravedigger? Hamlet asks. I came to it that day young Hamlet was born. I've been sexton here, man and boy, 30 years. Ben First Folio says, I've been 16 here, comma. Man and boy, 30 years. The gravedigger started work at 14, normal age for an Elizabethan, and he's been on this ground in Denmark for 30 years. It's the gravedigger that's 30, not Hamlet. And this has significant implications. For instance, Gertrude's a young woman of childbearing age. She can bear Claudius, a rival heir. Hamlet will never take the throne. He'll never take the crown. Now think about the nasty family power struggle going on inside Elsinore for the succession. If Gertrude's pregnant, or if she could be pregnant, and Hamlet knows this, you can turn up the dial on that to 11. Everybody thinks that the to-be-or-not-to-be speech is Hamlet unpacking his noble heart to the audience. But in fact, what we're watching is a classic Elizabethan eavesdropping scene, and Hamlet knows that Claudius and Polonius are behind the curtains there. He's just finished unmasking Rosencrantz and Guildenstern and plotting the mousetrap. His suspicions are at a peak, and Claudius sends for him. And what he delivers is the classic set speech of an Elizabethan melancholic schoolboy. There's not a single first-person pronoun in it. Every other soliloquy is lousy with them. They're all about Hamlet. This is manipulation and gaming, not philosophy. But as it turns out, it doesn't work. Likewise, The Mousetrap, the play that Hamlet puts on to catch the conscience of the king, total fail. Just before Lucianus pours poison in the player king's ear, Hamlet says that Lucianus is nephew to the king. So what the courtiers and the king see is the nephew of the king murdering the king in a play put on by the nephew and stepson of the current king. There's of course Claudius is furious. Hamlet learns nothing about the murder. In fact, Hamlet is the only revenge tragedy in history, classical or Elizabethan, in which nobody knows the murder happened. Claudius knows. He admits it to us, the audience, twice. But Hamlet heard from this ghost who he doesn't trust. Even at the end of the play, especially at the end of the play, with everybody dead, nobody even knows that the murder ever happened. In Hamlet's dying words, the rest is silence. I hope you like that. If you want to know more, my new book's just out in second edition and ebook. And come and talk to me. Ask me questions. I love talking about this stuff. Thank you very much.
Steve Roth, speaking as part of the 22nd Ignite Seattle at Town Hall on November 20th. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of the program by going to kuow.org/speakersforum. John O'Brien recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
More Ignite Seattle in a moment, 919, 94.9 KUOW. Starting January 1st, Seattle police will be following new use of force guidelines announced this week. Also starting next year, consumers will be able to buy marijuana over the counter, and a report this week indicates those consumers may be consuming much more pot than the state had initially estimated. Those are a few of the stories from the news this week that we'll take up on The Week in Review with news analyst Joni Balter, Knut Berger, the Mossback at crosscut.com, and Eli Sanders, associate editor at The Stranger. That'll be tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock. Forecast for the Seattle area for tonight, lows near 30, mostly cloudy this evening, snow likely after midnight, snow accumulation around 1 inch tonight. Friday highs lower to mid-40s, breezy. Snow in the morning, changing to rain by late morning. Additional snow accumulation around 1 inch for a total of a possible 2 inches. Support for KUOW comes from Sound Mental Health, whose mission is to help vulnerable families in the community, home, or school with specialized preventive mental health programs. Learn more about donating during the holidays at smh.org. Support for KUOW comes from Swedish, announcing the opening of a health insurance information desk for those who have questions about which new health plans in Washington include Swedish in the provider networks. More information at swedish.org.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. As part of Ignite Seattle, a number of speakers take the stage at Town Hall. They have 5 minutes to deliver a lecture. November's speakers discuss topics such as protest, compassion, and how to live in two different cities. The program was moderated by Seattle Times columnist Monica Guzman.
So a lot of protests don't necessarily go really anywhere, but a lot do. And our next speaker, who has a little bit of a background in politics, is going to tell you how protest can be really effective. So please welcome to the stage Darcy Berner.
So I'm Darcy Berner, and I try to fix injustice. That's what I do. I'm up here today to talk to you about protest because the activist in me wants all of you out on the streets fighting injustice, and the former programmer in me wants you all to do it in a way that might actually work. If we want people to do things, there are two ways we can go about it. We can use force, but force doesn't really scale very well over long periods of time or large numbers of people, as anyone who has ever been a mother can tell you. Or we can get people to try to consent, and consent actually scales much better. We consent to sit quietly and listen in the audience. We consent to obey traffic laws. But sometimes people consent to really terrible things. Sometimes they consent to great injustices. They consent to genocide, murder, discrimination, that sort of thing. And we can use protest as a way to get them to stop consenting to tremendous injustice. Now, protests have an audience, and we're trying to get that audience to stop consenting to the injustice, and there are 5 elements we need for that to happen. First, you have to have protesters who are perceived by your audience as being innocent of any wrongdoing. No rocks, no guns, no violence, no fighting back. This is the heart of nonviolence. You cannot have them be perceived of any wrongdoing. They have to be perceived as being innocent. Those innocent protesters then need to voluntarily put themselves in harm's way. It needs to be obvious that they are in fact endangered. If there's no real danger to the protesters, there's not any real danger that the protest is actually going to have enough impact to get people to stop consenting. And it's a terrible thing to say because we don't like people to get hurt for fighting for what they believe in. But this is, in fact, a key element of effective protest. That risk is what brings it home emotionally for the people whose consent you're trying to undermine. They then need to be subject to the use of official force. You need for official force to come down on these people in a way that's really visible. It can happen in a moment or it can happen over decades, but you have to capture it on film. They say that a picture is worth 1,000 words, and who has time and patience to read 1,000 words these days? You have got to make sure you have photographers or videographers capturing the moment in which official force comes down on your protesters. And then you need to broadcast that as widely as possible to your audience through whatever mechanisms you have. Now, I've had people tell me they don't think Occupy accomplished anything, but there were 3 moments that were broadcast in Occupy that almost everyone in the country saw. They saw young women being pepper sprayed outside Zuccotti Park, they saw an 84-year-old woman being pepper sprayed in Seattle, and they saw protesters being pepper sprayed while sitting on the sidewalk at UC Davis. And the conversation about our economy changed from one that was entirely centered around deficits to one that was centered around inequality, which is an enormous shift. And finally, protest is most effective if it shocks the conscience. The greater the shock to the conscience, the greater the effectiveness, which is also a fairly horrible thing to say, but which is true. 5 elements if you want effective protest. You need protesters who are innocent of any wrongdoing. They need to voluntarily put themselves in harm's way. They need to be subject to the use of official force. It needs to be broadcast very broadly to your audience in a way that shocks the conscience. if you have these five elements, you can use protest to change the world. Like Doralee Rainey, you can change the conversation about the economy of the most powerful country in the world. That's not big enough. How about overthrowing a century of imperialist rule without the use of political power, economic power, or military power, strictly through the use of these five rules in protest? Or, if you don't like that, how about if we take two centuries of institutionalized discrimination and we fundamentally rewrite the way society works by the use of these five rules? You can use protest to change the world, contrary to many of the protests that go on, but you have to have all five of those elements. If you want to know how to do it, this is how. Innocents voluntarily putting themselves in harm's way in a way that is broadcast to the rest of the world, that shocks the conscience, and that involves the use of official force. That's how you change the world with protest. Thank you.
Thank you, Darcy. Our next speaker traveled to Egypt, and things got interesting. So, Hannah Okert Axelson, please take the stage.
So there's a concept that's been bouncing around lately about how to create more global, compassionate societies around the world. And that's why I'm here today. I'm here to talk about my travels to Egypt and back. So last summer, I went to Egypt, and I worked for a nonprofit organization called ISEC as an event manager for a conference. I lived with a host family. I had a lot of Egyptian friends. I traveled around the country. I got to see a lot of Cairo. But I was still just a foreigner caught in yet another unraveling protest. And this protest ended in the revolution of Mohamed Morsi, affiliated to the Muslim Brotherhood, being disposed of by the head of the Egyptian army. In Egypt, this wasn't seen as just another person being taken out of power and this whole wrongdoing. We democratically elected him, sure, but he didn't follow the process of democracy after the election was over. And this became abundantly clear to me one day as I was negotiating the streets of Cairo, which have traffic pretty legendarily known for moving at a pace that could be compared to as glacial, which is funny because Egypt's really hot. So I am very clearly not Egyptian. And I, in Egypt, very clearly not Egyptian. Foreign, white, blonde hair, blue eyes, don't speak Arabic, driving my car kind of in a confused, manic way, and at any given point, probably close to panicking. And that's probably because driving in Egypt is an experience all in itself. The concepts of lanes or signaling or stoplights, not really phenomenons observed by the average Egyptian driver. But as I sit in my car in the traffic on the 6th of October Bridge, I realize that the drivers in the cars next to me aren't really all that different from when I sit in my car on the traffic on the West Seattle Bridge on the I-5. And then I start to near my exit. And that hot flash of stress starts boiling around my ears as I try to navigate the way to not go to Tahrir Square. So don't go straight, don't go right, don't go the far right, take the U-turn roundabout and hope that you end up in the right lane to go to the office. I get off the exit, or I get off the freeway, and there's a lot of people on the streets. And I mean, it's Egypt, there's cars and vehicles and tuk-tuks and lots of people all over the place, but not like this. Not like this. These people are going all in the same direction, from one side of the street to the other. Some of them are running, some of them are yelling, some of them are taking their children into side alleys. And the imagination of a foreign, white, blonde, non-Egyptian starts to think about the pro-Morsi protests that's about to break out on this very spot where I'm completely stuck without GPS, not knowing where I'm going, in the middle of a country where I don't speak the language. But I try not to panic. I notice that a man has locked eyes with me. A man wearing a traditional Egyptian galabeya with a beard, a little bit older, and he starts to walk towards me. I'm silently screaming in my head, hoping that he doesn't bug me, but that's not the case. He comes over to my car and tucks in the side mirrors and starts guiding me through the traffic in spaces about the size of this one for almost 15 blocks until we get to a free street away from the potential protest. And on that hot Egyptian day, I saw the kindness of a stranger who had absolutely no reason to help me, besides that I was probably in a place where I could really use it. And before he left, he smiled and waved goodbye. We were not from the same country. We didn't have the same political affiliation. We couldn't speak the same language. We couldn't communicate. But that smile was the universal language. Everyone can smile. And as Westerners, it makes me think, we've been conditioned to be afraid of the scary, galabang, bearded Muslims walking the streets without actually even trying to understand their real intent. They want stability of state and respect of their human rights. Don't we all? This man taught me that we need more global ambassadors of the world, for the people. Civility, cultural stability, equality, these are all global concepts that anyone can understand. And I went to Egypt through an organization called ISEC, which gives 20,000 young students the opportunity to travel the world and to discover themselves. My name is Hannah Okert Axelson. I'm a global ambassador, and you can be too. Thank you.
Thank you, Hannah. Now, it can be pretty hard to live in one city with, you know, paying your rent and finding an apartment, getting around. Our next speaker is going to tell you how he lives equally in two cities on the opposite, in the opposite sides of the country. So, David Hong, tell us what that's like.
Good evening. When we first meet someone, we usually get asked three questions. What's your name? What do you do? And where do you live? My name's David Hong. I'm a UX designer, and I live in Seattle, Washington. I also live in Brooklyn, New York. This means every 2 weeks, I fly from Seattle to New York and then spend my time there, and 2 weeks later, fly back. Now, I have two places, but one home. So before I tell you how, I need to tell you why. It's because we can. We live in a day and age where we're becoming more portable and more remote, yet at the same time, we're staying more connected. The other reason I do this is to be open to opportunities. I want to continue to explore New York, but I want to be here with my friends in Seattle. I want to see my friends' kids grow up, and I want to be here when my parents get old. Big question, money. We all can't be Batman, Iron Man, or Elon Musk, but what we need to do is prioritize what's important to us, what we need, and cut the rest out. This is one example of how I cut money down. Instead of getting specialty coffee, I'll get a regular coffee. That's $730 a year. That's two flights to Seattle to New York, or four to San Francisco. Find what you can cut out. I love Venn diagrams, so I put one together. This is really all I need. Anything else is just a luxury. I realized I don't need a car. I would like cable, but I don't need it, so it's out. You need to become portable, too. This is all I pack on my trip. The rest is at the places. I treat my flight like my daily commute. If I don't use it for the day, it doesn't go in the bag. This is what my schedule looked like for November. I knew this week I wanted to go to the Nine Inch Nails concert, and of course, I wanted to go to Ignite. So I had to take care of all of my New York stuff before then. So plan. The other thing I need to tell you to do is also not plan, because things change. Maybe you meet someone that you want to spend the day with. Maybe you miss your flight and have to go to Portland and have your parents pick you up. That could happen. That did happen. So... Make a checklist. Remember, now that you live in two cities, you have half the time, so make use of your time. I make a checklist of the things I want to do and what's a priority. And when I get to it, I get to it. Make it fun, too. When I was in Europe, I had this little blog that I started called Vader Vacation. If you see Amelie, you know exactly what this is. I travel around the world and take photos of this Darth Vader action figure and send it to my friends. It gives me something to do and something to share with friends. The other thing I want to do, encourage you to do, is to sketch. I sketch and draw all the time because it gives you perspective. I didn't realize how much I missed Seattle until I was away from it, and how much I loved New York until I was away from it. You also need to stay in touch. This is how my family stays in touch. We do Google Hangouts. I send postcards to friends and family wherever I am, and we send messages to each other. So the channels are there. These are some of the things I use when going back and forth. The thing I like using right now is Simple, which I use to budget for Seattle and New York. If I don't have the money in the budget, I don't use it. Simple as that. Now, stay connected. The people up here are just a few people that came to New York from Seattle to visit me. I'm not trying to separate my life. I'm trying to bring it together. Next year, New York friends are coming to Seattle. Some advice from my friend Jamie. It's not about what's next, but what's important. I realized I didn't want to go Seattle, then New York, then Seattle. I needed both in my life. There's no compromise, so I had to do whatever it takes. The other advice is from my friend Leslie, who I met in New York, and she says, treat life like a video game. Now, she's not the first person to say this, but she's been living in both cities, and she told me, just set your mission, figure out how to do it, and just do whatever it takes. Now, you might not want to live in two cities, so take what you've learned from this and apply it to something else. What about that side project you've been working on? What about that dream vacation or dream house you've been meaning working on? Set your goals. Treat it as your second city. I'm going to end on this note. This is my cat, and he lives in two cities. When I'm in New York, he goes to Portland. So my challenge to you as an audience is if this cat can live in two cities, so can you. Thank you, and I'll find...
David Hong, speaking as part of the 22nd Ignite Seattle at Town Hall on November 20th. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of the program by going to kuow.org/speakersforum. John O'Brien recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
More Ignite Seattle in a moment, 938 94.9 KUOW. Saturday is the shortest day of the year. That means we'll have only 8.5 hours of sunlight in our case here in the city of Seattle. But amid the darkness of the season comes holidays filled with light. Christians have Christmas. Jews have Hanukkah. But what holiday do Muslims have in December? We'll talk about it with the three interfaith amigos, Pastor Don McKenzie, Rabbi Ted Falcon, and Imam Jamal Rahman. That'll be at noon tomorrow. Lows near 30 tonight, says the forecast. Mostly cloudy this evening. Snow likely after midnight. Snow accumulation around 1 inch. Friday highs lower to mid-40s, breezy. Snow in the morning changing to rain by late morning. Additional snow accumulation around 1 inch. A total of 2 inches is possible. 8-time Grammy-winning singer, guitarist, and composer Jose Feliciano joins Michael Feinstein for music and conversation in a few minutes at 10 o'clock. Support for KUOW comes from University Volkswagen Audi, committed to providing customer care through the exclusive Passport Service Program, which includes service loaner vehicles, rideshare shuttle service, and a knowledgeable staff. More information online at uvwaudi.com.
Hello, this is Renee Montaigne of NPR News. And we're getting to the time where we're thinking about the kinds of tax-deductible donations we make at the end of the year. And while you're thinking, put at the top of your list, KUOW. KUOW is here for you every day of the year because listeners who value public radio support it. You may have recently received a special appeal in the mail. Please mail it back with your donation or donate online at kuow.org. Thank you.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. Ignite Seattle 22 took place November 20th at Town Hall. The premise of the regular event is that speakers get 5 minutes on stage to deliver a lecture on any topic they choose. The event was moderated by Seattle Times columnist Monica Guzman.
So some doors don't open the first time you knock. Our next speaker, Keena McAllister, is going to tell us about her journey from reject to lab tech. Keena.
So I'm the kind of person who wakes up in the morning and spends way more time doing my hair and makeup than eating breakfast before work. I'm the kind of person who reads Cosmo way too many times a year to find out the same 42 sex tips and if they found a new one yet. I'm the kind of person with a small purse dog that has her own sizable wardrobe and a personal carry bag. But I'm also the kind of person who wrote her senior thesis on the disruption of the CCR5, CXCR4 chemokine co-receptors on the surface of your CD4 positive T cells in order to prevent and cure an HIV infection. And I happen to be a lab tech in a gene therapy-based research lab that's focusing on cures for HIV. So in college, I decided to major in general science with a focus in chemistry and biology. And shortly after, I realized my passion for research. And I like research for 3 reasons. Number 1, I want to help people. Number 2, I want to help a lot of people. And number 3, I want to change the world. But before I can start changing the world, I have to get my foot in the door, right? Well, that actually ended up being the hardest part. So for 2 years, I approached every professor I knew that had a lab. I asked my advisor for countless outside opportunities. I contacted so many HR reps in the area. And I scoured way too many Craigslist ads and some really weird things out there. So as you can guess, for 2 years, I was turned down by every opportunity that I approached. And I get it. The economy is in really bad shape, and times are hard. Science is already this very competitive field to break into. So there are a lot of people out there that look way better on paper than I do, and I get that. That's great. Good for you. But what I can't understand are the rejections that were made by people who never saw my credentials or my resume. There was one such instance in college when I approached a professor who I was told had room in his lab for another student researcher. I came to the meeting on time. I was ready to discuss his research as I had read a few of his papers beforehand, but it became clear not long into the meeting that he was not going to take me or this meeting seriously. So after letting me know the position for which I wanted to interview was not there, it didn't exist, he offered to put me in contact with a colleague that would be willing to help a fellow chica out. And yes, he called me a chica. So not long after, I actually found out from a lab mate that he had been hired for the position that I was told did not exist by that professor only days after my meeting. So it's not just things like big events in my life that remind me I'm not who people think a scientist should be. It's little things like the Big Bang Theory. Yeah, I know, we're going to complain about this now. So all the characters on the show that are scientists are identified as socially inept, awkward, brilliant minds, but I identify more with Penny, the awkward, like, the stupid girl neighbor, so that's a problem. And the second thing is that it's not just the things that are there, it's the things that aren't. If anyone in this audience can name a female scientist as popular as Bill Nye or Neil deGrasse Tyson, I will buy you a drink after the show, because you can't, and I also don't carry cash, which they want, so now that I'm in a lab, I can definitely see it takes all kinds of people to be a scientist. Yet I still feel that pressure to be that stereotypical scientist. And sometimes it's so tempting to conform because I want people to look at me and I want them to see a good scientist. But you know what? I know that I am a good scientist and that I have what it takes to go far in this field. And I enjoy being who I am, which is a girly girl who likes to have fun and is loud and obnoxious. I like who I am, and I don't need to change that to be a good scientist. So to the people out there who feel like they are not the stereotype, good, work it. That is part of how I got into the field. I went to this lecture, I asked a million questions, and I was obnoxious because I wanted my answers, and I got them. And then after the lecture, I went to that amazing scientist and I told him, I want to be a part of your lab. And here I am. I'm in the field now. So I don't know how to fix this problem, and I don't know how to change people's minds about me, but what I do know is that science is a field for people who have questions and are willing to work hard for those questions. It doesn't matter how you dress, it doesn't matter what your gender is, it doesn't matter what personality type you are or aren't. If people are not willing to change the stereotype of science, we are going to lose out on some great ideas and new ways of thinking, and that's not just bad for science, but everyone. Thank you.
Thank you, Kina. So, what are we eating? It's a good question, and our next speaker, Mandy Sorensen, is going to give an interesting answer. Mandy.
Hi, guys. I'm Mandy Sorensen, and tonight I want to tell you a story about superbugs and the way our food system contributes to them. And our story begins in the 1940s. And like most great stories, it begins with gonorrhea. No, that's a lie. It doesn't begin with gonorrhea. It begins with the penicillin that cured the gonorrhea. And in the 1940s, penicillin became a popular treatment for a lot of different conditions in humans and animals. And over time, farmers found that as they fed their animals antibiotics regularly, they actually grew faster, so they could get to market faster. And that's a good thing for farming, and certainly was especially good at the time as factory farms were becoming a lot more popular. What we see now that it's in widespread use, 80% of the antibiotics that we sell in this country go towards making animals grow faster. Only 20% are used for treating diseases in humans or animals. That's a shockingly high number that's actually not of antibiotics not being used to treat any specific disease. These antibiotics are also available over the counter for farmers. They don't have veterinary oversight, and we don't keep track of what animal gets what, how often, or what combination of antibiotics. So, basically, with bacteria, it's survival of the fittest. You take an animal, and we all have lots of bacteria all over the place. But as you get exposed to antibiotics on a regular basis, eventually, some of those bacteria die off. Some actually learn resistance. And bacteria aren't very smart, but they really kick ass at evolution. And so you can see multiple strains of antibiotic-resistant bacteria developing in a single animal. And we call these animals colonized. So basically, at that point, we've got a superbug. And this thing that looks like it just came out of Predator is actually Salmonella. This is the Salmonella that caused the recent foodborne illness outbreak that was related to Foster Farms chicken just a couple of months ago. So what happens when people get superbugs? Well, terrible food poisoning, which we'll hear more about later. Urinary tract infections actually can be caused by eating contaminated meat. And this horrible wound, that's actually a methicillin-resistant staph lesion, or MRSA. It's flesh-eating bacteria. So who can get superbugs? Anybody. Animals, humans, birds. Even if you have a giant bayonet on your rifle, you can get a superbug. You might have one already. So no one is safe. How do they spread? Animal to animal. One animal's colonized, all of his buddies get colonized, especially on a factory farm where there are high numbers of animals in a small space. Or contaminated meat gets into the population. We get urinary tract infections, food poisoning. Number three, exposed farm workers. And this is actually how MRSA got into the population. It started with a pig. And on a pig farm, the farm worker got exposed and brought it out to the population at large. But maybe the most major way is it's from farm runoff. So all of that waste material gets into our groundwater, our soil, then it's in our fruits, vegetables, fish. We get it through eating those contaminated things, or we can get it directly from the environment. So this seems like a dumb question, but why don't we just discontinue antibiotics for making animals grow faster? It's a great question, and I don't have a good answer. We do a pretty poor job in the U.S. of actually keeping track of any antibiotic resistance. And honestly, industry is against it. And unfortunately, industry is involved in a lot of our government decisions when it relates to food. For factory farms, it makes a lot more sense to continue feeding antibiotics to animals and making them grow faster. You make more money. In Europe, things are great. They stopped using antibiotics to make animals grow faster. And you know what? They've seen a decrease in resistance in their bacteria. They've also seen that they can make animals grow just as fast by not raising them like this. You actually give them space to move. You keep it clean. They do great. Turns out we all thrive when we aren't treated like crap. So basically, you just can't have a factory farming system. So what can you guys do about it? One, be aware of where you get your food. Make sure it's not from a factory farm, and that takes a lot of research because a lot of the labeling is really confusing. And we might think, oh, hey, organic. That's the answer, right? Organic for everything. Unfortunately, organic means no antibiotics ever, which also means a sick animal can't get the antibiotics it needs to get healthy. If they do, they can't be sold as an organic animal, and the farmer takes a loss. So it's really not fair to farmers or to animals to withhold antibiotics. So this went by really fast. I could talk about this for about 6 more hours. So if you have any questions, just come find me or email me. But thank you guys very much.
Thank you, Mandy. I know who you want to hear from next. You want to hear from a 2-time E. coli survivor who has an idea on how to reduce food poisoning in King County. Give it up for Sarah Schott.
Twenty years ago, my family, including my 5-year-old brother, got E. coli in the Jack in the Box outbreak. As I watched my 5-year-old brother writhe in pain from the caused by E. coli, and I got a secondary case, my mom did too. Meanwhile, over 700 people across the United States were infected, 178 with permanent injuries from E. coli. Several died, including children. This was me at the time. My family lived, but it left me permanently impacted and thinking, we can do better. We can prevent foodborne illness. And so as a kid, I spent every report opportunity researching factory farming, slaughterhouses, regulation on meat processing, and foodborne illness. And what I found was startling. But today, when I got, well, not today, but this year, when I got E. coli again for the second time in my life through a restaurant, It inspired me to go back to research, even though no report was due. And I found that, one, in the United States today, the CDC says that 15% of us will get foodborne illness each year. In a room like that, like this, that's 90 of you, sucks to be you, who are going to get foodborne illness this year. 60 of you, according to Washington State, will get food poisoning from a restaurant. Now, in between bouts of E. coli, I'm actually an open government expert. I've advised governments around the world. That's me with the Afghan delegation at a United Nations meeting. I ran conferences and open government nonprofit, and I even helped the city of Seattle. I put together a usability study for them on seattle.gov. If you saw the redesign, we helped put that in, and it became number one, or the best municipal website in America as a result. Now, as I researched foodborne illness in King County, I found that King County's own website hadn't been redesigned since 2002, and the way that they presented the data on very valuable data on restaurant inspections in our county was actually very difficult to interpret. A multi-level scoring system that when I tested on friends and family, they didn't know how to properly interpret the scores. Meanwhile, in counties like LA and municipalities like New York, they had implemented an ABC scoring system. Now, this is an analog version of that data. They posted it's mandatory at restaurants, and these types of signs bring down foodborne illness hospitalizations by on average 14%, sometimes up to 19%. And because most people never report their foodborne illness, this means a much more significant portion of the population never got sick. Now, Yelp this year approached multiple municipalities like King County and said, hey, we'd like to put a standardized restaurant inspection score on Yelp. Now, whether we love or hate Yelp, sites like it are where we're going for restaurant information. Would have been handy because that's where I found the top rated by consumers restaurant I got sick from that had 5 out of 6 of its last inspections as unsatisfactory in King County. But when I went to King County and I said, hey, let's improve our scoring, let's make it easier to use, let's drive down rates, I was met with risk management lawyers, which was kind of surprising for a person like me. And I wanted to help. I volunteered 30 of my hours, but I never really, besides one meeting, heard back, and I kind of chased him for 3 months saying, let's prevent people from getting sick, and nothing. So I started a change.org petition, and I got over 1,500 signatures and lots of media attention. I was on the network news, pretty solid. This finally caught their attention. And I'm proud to say that King County right now is reviewing its current restaurant rating system and is considering launching a new ratings process soon. And what I'm advocating to King County is that we simplify our rating system, keep the complex measurements that you need to do your work as public health, but let's have simple grading that helps us represent and quickly interpret whether we're online or off, what's safe and what's not. And I'm also recommending to them to bring usability testing into the design process for creating a new set of standardized restaurant scoring. We can A/B test as we do in marketing and in websites. There are a lot of tools that we could use. What if we had a few kind of fake food trucks set up with the same score on each, but a different format for the score, and tested how people are spending their money and how safe they felt? I think that we can design processes that make us all safe. And you can sign the petition still. We need to keep pressure on King County to make this happen. I think if we make it possible here, we can make it possible across the United States. Thank you so much, and eat safe.
Sarah Schacht, speaking as part of the 22nd Ignite Seattle at Town Hall on November 20th. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of the program by going to kuow.org/speakersforum. John O'Brien recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from Westland Distillery, American single malt whiskey distilled, matured, and bottled in Seattle, Washington. Distillery tours available by appointment. Learn more at www.westlanddistillery.com. Support for KUOW comes from the Seattle Channel on Cable 21, connecting to life in the city with stories about Seattle's politics, culture, business, and more. Local television designed to engage, inform, and inspire. Information at seattlechannel.org. 959 KUOW FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services. I'm Bill O'Grady. Washington's Liquor Control Board has issued recommendations to regulate medical marijuana. They want to reduce the number of plants medical patients can grow from 15 to 6. The board also wants to eliminate collective gardens, and the board has recommended to exempt patients from sales taxes. These recommendations come after the board's first draft. That draft received many criticisms from the medical pot community. We'll talk about whether or not the board met all their concerns with John Davis, owner and CEO of two Seattle medical marijuana dispensaries. That'll be during the noon hour tomorrow. Lows near 30 tonight, mostly cloudy this evening, snow likely after midnight. Friday highs lower to mid-40s, breezy, snow in the morning changing to rain by late afternoon. Total snowfall could be 2 inches.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.